fantastic week.
This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky Sunday urged the European Union to ban tourist visas for Russians. Details from VOA's Marissa Melton.
Zelensky said Sunday during his nightly video address that he spoke with European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen about the bloc's next round of EU sanctions on Moscow. Meanwhile, nearly 600 Ukrainians have returned from Russian captivity, according to Oleksandr Smirnov, head of Ukraine's National Information Bureau. He said in a television interview Sunday that about 100 of that group are civilians and about 500 are members of the military. He said Ukraine has confirmed nearly 40,000 forced deportations, but added that the true number is probably far higher. Experts say disappearances are especially difficult to track.
That is VOA's Marissa Melton reporting. Energy problems have plagued Ukraine and Europe, as much of the Russian-occupied region that's home to our largely crippled nuclear power plant was reported temporarily in blackout. Only one of six reactors at the plant was connected to the electricity grid, and Russia's main pipeline carrying natural gas to Germany remained shut down on Sunday. The fighting in Ukraine and related disputes over pipelines lie behind the electricity and natural gas shortfalls that have worsened as Russia's war in Ukraine grinds on for a seventh month. UN nuclear agency inspectors are scheduled to brief the Security Council Tuesday about their visit to the power plant in Ukraine. European Union energy ministers are planning to meet on Friday to discuss the bloc's troubled electricity blackout in March. There's more at voanews.com. Again, voanews.com. This is VOA News. A series of stabbings at an indigenous community and at another town nearby in the Canadian province of Saskatchewan has left 10 people dead, 15 wounded. Canadian police say as they search for two suspects, the stabbings took place in multiple locations on the James Smith Cree Nation and in the village of Weldon, northeast of Saskatoon. Rhonda Blackmore, the assistant commissioner of the RCMP Saskatchewan, said some of the victims appear to have been targeted by the suspects, but others appear to have been attacked at random. She could not provide a motive. She said there are 13 crime scenes where either deceased or injured people were found. The Israeli military says Palestinian gunmen opened fire on a bus in the occupied West Bank, wounding five soldiers, one of them seriously, and the civilian driver of the bus. The Israeli military said the attackers were traveling in a pickup truck when they threw an explosive and then opened fire at the bus. The suspects fled the scene in their vehicle, which burst into flames shortly after the shooting. Two of the men exited the burning vehicle and were caught, while the third suspect remained on the run late Sunday. Chris Chen, a former captain in Taiwan's military, spent a lot of time waiting during his weeks-long training for a reservist in June. Waiting for assembly, waiting for lunch, waiting for training, Russia's invasion of Ukraine has underscored the importance of mobilizing civilians who were under attack as Ukraine's reserve forces helped fend off the invaders. Nearly halfway around the world, it was highlighted Taiwan's weakness on that front, chiefly in two areas, its reserves and a civilian defense force. Even before the invasion of Ukraine in March, Taiwan was working on reforming both. The question is whether it will be tough enough. Chileans have resoundingly rejected a new constitution to replace a charter imposed by the dictatorship of General Augusto Pinochet years ago, dealing a stinging setback to the president, Gabriel Boric, who urged the document would usher in a progressive era. With 99% of the votes counted in Sunday's election, the rejection camp had 61.9 support compared to 38.1 for approval amid what appeared to be a heavy turnout with long lines at polling stations. More at voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Today is Monday, September 5th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinadolfo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, U.S. accuses Russia of, quote, weaponizing, unquote, energy as the Kremlin shuts off a major gas pipeline to Germany over support for Ukraine.
Close to the Finnish border, Russia is burning off huge amounts of gas. Russia has been destroying an estimated $10 million worth of gas every day as Europe suffers from shortages.
Pakistan braces for more rains as diseases hit camps and shelters of victims of a historic flooding.
The provincial health minister in Southern Sindh province, one of the hardest hit regions, issued some alarming figures about the kind of outbreak of diseases that area has been experiencing.
And coastal seawater creeps further inland in South Asia, destroying rice-growing fields. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. President Volodymyr Zelensky said on Sunday that his forces had taken two settlements in southern Ukraine, a third settlement in the east, and additional territory in the east of the country. He did not say precisely where the territories were, and provided no timeline except to say he had received, quote, good reports, unquote, at a meeting on Sunday from his military commanders and head of intelligence. In his nightly video address, Zelensky thanked his forces for liberating a settlement in eastern Donetsk region and taking, quote, certain heights, unquote, also in an eastern area in the Lysychansk and Siverek direction and liberating two southern settlements. Zelensky said he had called on the EU to urgently allocate its next round of aid to Ukraine and pressed for a new wave of sanctions on Russia in a phone call with European Commission Chief Ursula von der Leyen. Ukraine Vice President Denis Shmyhal said earlier that Kyiv was expecting a tranche of 5 billion euros in microfinancial aid from the EU this coming week. Russia has shut off a major gas pipeline in Germany as Europe and the US accuse Russian President Vladimir Putin of, quote, weaponizing energy, unquote. And as Henry Ridgewell reports from London, there are growing environmental concerns over an unexplained Russian gas flare close to the Arctic.
Close to the Finnish border, Russia is burning off huge amounts of gas. Although flaring is common in the industry, Russia has been destroying an estimated $10 million worth of gas every day for 2 months as Europe suffers from shortages. Experts describe it as an environmental disaster. Esa Vakilainen is a professor of energy systems at LUT University in Finland.
Due to the war in Ukraine, there is very little information about what is actually happening there. So we can only speculate that right now there is some technical difficulties.
The location is Portovaya in Russia, the site of the compressor station for the Nord Stream 1 gas pipeline that runs under the Baltic Sea to Germany. Russia's state-owned Gazprom has not commented on the flare. In recent weeks, Russia cut flows through Nord Stream 1 to just 20% of capacity. And this week, it has been shut down entirely for 3 days. Russia says the turbines need maintenance. Europe disputes this and accuses the Kremlin of using gas as a weapon. The governor of the state of Bavaria, Markus Söder, spoke to reporters Wednesday. He said, I think it's a kind of game. Our problem right now is that we are not in a position to adequately respond to this game. European gas prices have soared to around 10 times their average price over the past decade. Germany declared a gas crisis in June and warned that consumers and businesses must cut back. Consumption has fallen by around 20%. In a stark speech, French President Emmanuel Macron warned of the end of abundance. He said, our freedom, the system of freedom which we are used to living in, has a cost. Russia supplied the European Union with 40% of its gas last year. As the Kremlin turns off the taps, Europe is scrambling to find alternative sources. Imports of liquefied natural gas, or LNG, including from the United States, have helped fill gas storage sites to 80% capacity, 2 months ahead of the EU target. That has calmed markets. Tom O'Donnell is an energy analyst at the Free University in Berlin.
Storage by itself isn't enough for the winter. with all the pipelines cut off, which is what we have to expect from Russia, that all their pipelines will be cut off, all the LNG we can take, you know, that storage is going to last 2.5 months in heating season. And then, you know, Europe's stuck.
Europe is trying to wean itself off Putin's gas, but analysts say it will take at least 2 years. Again, Tom O'Donnell.
In the meantime, he has leverage and he will use it all he can before he totally loses the business. The dependence of Europe on Russian delivered gas by pipeline is much greater than the, let's say, the importance of that money for Putin, because he makes so much more money from oil.
Across Europe, new LNG terminals are under construction. Old coal and nuclear power plants are being fired up again. There is big investment in renewable power. But short term, it may not be enough, and governments are warning of a difficult winter ahead. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Pakistan is bracing for more rains and is requesting for more international assistance for victims of a historic flooding as fears of diseases in overcrowded camps and shelters grow. For more, I spoke with VOA's Ayaz Gaul.
The United Nations and aid workers have been warning about the outbreak of diseases, but today the provincial health minister in southern Sindh province, one of the hardest hit regions, issued some alarming figures about the kind of outbreak of diseases that that area has been experiencing. And she said that, like, authorities have documented almost 200,000 cases of diarrhea and malaria, the waterborne diseases there, and there are other infections as well. That's quite a large number. And the reason for this outbreak is obvious, that the large swathes of territory districts there in southern Sindh province are still under water, inundated seriously, that even relief assistance cannot be provided to these victims who are trapped in these waters. So that's quite a scary situation that the provincial minister presented today to reporters. And obviously, there are no signs of receding, because we have forecast for more rains over the next 3-4 days. And if that happens, obviously, things will really get out of control of the authorities in terms of the diseases that are now hitting people in the calamity hit area and also in makeshift camps.
The government is asking for more international assistance. What exactly are they requesting from the international community?
The immediate needs are medicines, hygienic kits, water. But the kind of the scale of the devastation is so huge that apparently the government is trying to convince the international community that whatever they are offering as of today, because we know that 35 plane loads of relief goods have already arrived in Pakistan over the last 2 weeks. But the government seems to be in a hurry to receive more pledges from the international community, because they estimate that the losses that the flooding has inflicted on infrastructure across Pakistan, at least $10 billion. That's a lot of amount. Everything is so challenging. And I think that's what seems to be the realization on part of the international community, because we know that today the United States has already promised to send its assessment teams to Pakistan, and the USAID, the United States aid agency, has already deployed a team of its experts to help coordinate relief assistance to some of the victims. So Pakistan is getting cooperation, but the challenge is quite huge. I mean, if you look at the devastation that these floods have caused, it's amazing, because you see vast areas. And another challenge happened today, that the largest freshwater lake in southern Sindh province has swollen to dangerous levels, and that forced the authorities there to cut into its embankment so that the water can flow into the Indus River nearby rather than going towards the populated areas. That is another challenge that in the last few hours has emerged for the authorities there. And if that water somehow is unable to eventually move into the Indus River and moves to these already inundated districts, things will deteriorate further. That's what officials told us today from the southern Sindh province.
That's VOA's Ayaz Gaul speaking with me from Islamabad. The World Food Programme warns that catastrophic floods in Pakistan are exacerbating the food crisis in neighbouring Afghanistan, where nearly half the population is facing acute hunger. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The UN agency has provided more than 16 million people in Afghanistan with emergency food assistance this year. Much of that aid travels by road through Pakistan. WFP Country Director for Pakistan, Chris Kay, says his agency has procured more than 320,000 metric tons of food in the past year to support operations in Afghanistan.
The floods in Pakistan are going to put a huge dent in that capability, and a greater reliance on imported food and commodities. So we're becoming very, very concerned about the overall food security, not only in Pakistan in the immediate medium term, but also for what it's going to imply for the operations in Afghanistan.
Several provinces in Afghanistan also have been hit by heavy rains and severe flooding in recent weeks. The United Nations reports thousands of homes and large areas of farmland have been destroyed. The Taliban say more than 180 people have been killed. Kay says Pakistan provides a vital supply route into Afghanistan. Speaking from Dubai, home to the largest international aid hub in the world, the WFP official says large amounts of food enter Pakistan via the port of Karachi, eventually crossing the border into Afghanistan.
With the challenges that we have now with roads that have been washed away, that presents us with a major logistical challenge and problem. The second element on this one is the fact that the flooded area, of course, is areas where the wheat harvest has been stored, and a large proportion of that wheat has been washed away.
Kay says climate change is having a devastating impact on the whole region and on food security. Before torrential rains inundated large parts of Pakistan, he notes 43% of the population was critically short of food. He says he expects the number of acutely hungry people to increase because of the current crisis. He adds a similar scenario is playing out in Afghanistan. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In other news, Canadian police say 10 people are dead in 13 locations at two communities in Saskatchewan. Police said 15 have been sent to hospitals after stabbing in multiple locations on the James Smith Cree Nation and the Nation of Weldon, northeast of Saskatoon. Police say some of the victims appear to have been targeted by the suspects, but others appear to have been attacked at random. Two suspects remain at large. The search for suspects was waged as fans descended in Regina for a sold-out annual Labor Day game between the Canadian Football League's Saskatchewan Rough Riders and Winnipeg Blue Bombers. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com and check out voaafrica.com for more English language programming. You can find International Edition and our current affairs program, Encounter, Press Conference USA and Issues in the News on voanews.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Afo in Washington. In Ethiopia's Gambela region, a June attack on the capital by the rebel group the Oromo Liberation Army has raised fears of more civil war spreading in the country. Reporter Henry Wilkins spoke to local officials and analysts about what's behind the violence and what it could mean for Ethiopia's security.
In Gambela City, security has been beefed up since June when rebel groups carried out a surprise attack here that reportedly killed as many as 37 people. Since then, local police have started working with troops sent here by federal government to protect against the rebel groups, the Oromo Liberation Army, OLA, and Gambela Liberation Front, GLF.
The shooting began around 6 a.m. We weren't expecting it, so we weren't well prepared. OLA and the GLF entered the city as far as the regional council building. They entered the city from three directions. I think the Gambela Liberation Front was leading the OLA.
Analysts say it is the first time the Oromo conflict, a decade-old fight between local and federal forces and ethnic Oromo rebels, has reached the Gambela city. Less than a week later, in the Oromia region, around 400 ethnic Amharas were killed by OLA militants. The rapid uptick in violence has some questioning if the conflict in Ethiopia now constitutes a second civil war. Data shows the number of deaths linked to the OLA increased 481% between August of 2021 to July of 2022 to 3,784 deaths, up from 651 deaths during the same period the previous year. Analysts say the increased violence is the result of long-standing grievances related to Oromo self-determination and lack of political representation in Ethiopia's federal system, especially since the current government came to power in 2018. The Oromo are the largest ethnic group in the country. Asked if the conflict is as significant as Ethiopia's headline-grabbing war with Tigrayan rebels in the north of the country, Davison replied, "For now, Gambella is calm, but fewer than 10 kilometres beyond its outskirts, local police say there are regular firefights with the OLA. Local officials are keen to project stability. But one other civil servant who witnessed the fighting says rumours abound that the OLA may return." Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Gambella, Ethiopia.
Thank you, Henry. Worldwide coastal seawater is creeping further and further inland, tainting the land and water with enough salt to kill crops. In Asia, saltwater intrusion is making it nearly impossible for some farmers to grow the region's staple food. Elise Katz has more.
Praknyon farms rice in Slaptaon village, a coastal settlement roughly 150 kilometers southwest of Cambodia's capital, Phnom Penh.
I've just transplanted rice seedlings and they die. They've become red. The salt is in the soil. The crops don't grow.
Saltwater has destroyed rice paddies in the village for the past 2 years. Praknyon doubts that he and the other villagers will be able to grow rice in the future. Around the world, climate change and other human-made changes to the environment are sinking the coasts and raising the seas. This allows seawater to seep inland. Seawater taints soils with salt, rendering farms infertile. In Asia, rising salinity threatens many key coastal regions where farmers grow rice, the continent's staple crop. International Rice Research Institute expert Bjørn Ole Sander is his organization's country representative for Vietnam. He says rice is critical for food security, especially in Asia.
It's the staple crop for more than half of the world's population. It provides more than 30% of calories in Southeast Asia. People eat rice every day with every meal.
In Vietnam, the world's number three rice exporter, salinity is rapidly transforming the Mekong River Delta, a low-lying coastal region that grows more than half of Vietnam's yearly rice yield. Co Van Wan says saltwater has damaged his farm in Vietnam's Long An province.
If there's fresh water, we can grow rice all year round. If there's none, nothing can be grown.
Experts say the Vietnamese government plans to adapt to salinity by scaling back rice farming and diversifying the Mekong River Delta away from mass production of cheap rice. But what's good for the Delta could be bad news elsewhere.
Most of the export rice of Vietnam comes from the Mekong River Delta, which means that the big rice importers, so the Philippines, for example, are a big rice importer from Vietnam. Also, some African countries import rice from Vietnam, Indonesia, in parts, that they hit also by climate change impacts and salinity impacts in the Mekong Delta.
Erie estimates that rice production globally will need to increase every year to keep rice affordable for billions of people who depend on the grain. At the same time, climate change and other human activity continues to raise sea level and sink shorelines. Elise Cutts, VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Operators of the James Webb Space Telescope are saying that it has taken its first direct image of a planet located outside of our solar system, or exoplanet. The extrasolar planet featured in the newly captured image is called HIP-65-426b. The planet is described as a gas giant, which is similar to our solar system's Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. In a James Webb Space Telescope blog post by Elise Fisher, the planet is about 6 to 12 times more massive than Jupiter and that it's astronomically young at about 15 to 20 million years of age. Earth, by comparison, is 4.5 billion years old. Scientists are examining data gathered from these observations and will write a study that will be presented to scientific journals for peer review. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Hey there, it's Shauna Renee, also known as the Lady DJ, inviting you to join me every Thursday at 10 and 2200 UTC for today's hit countdown. Each week, I count down the top 20 songs in pop music according to Billboard and Rolling Stone magazines, but more importantly, according to you, the VOA listeners. Again, that's Thursdays at 10 and 2200 UTC right here on VOA 1.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. And check out voaafrica.com for more English language programming. You can find International Edition and our current affairs program Encounter, Press Conference USA and Issues in News on voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinedu in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The State Department has barred Paraguay and Vice President Hugo Velasquez from entering the United States due to his involvement in significant corruption, including bribery of a public official and interference in public processes, said Secretary of State Antony Blinken. Vice President Velasquez announced his resignation from office and will no longer run for president in the next election. The United States also designated Yacyretá Binational Entity Legal Counsel Juan Carlos Charlie Duarte for involvement in significant corruption. Duarte, a close personal and professional associate of Vice President Velasquez, offered a bribe to a Paraguayan public official in order to obstruct an investigation that threatened the vice president and his financial interests, explained Secretary Blinken in a statement. Corrupt acts such as these also contribute to diminished confidence in the government and public perceptions of corruption and impunity within the office of the Paraguayan vice president, he added. Moreover, Duarte's act of corruption abused and exploited his privileged public position within the Yacyretá binational entity, risking public confidence in one of Paraguay's most vital economic assets. Duarte has since been removed from his post at Yacyretá, said Paraguayan President Mario Abdo Benitez. The U.S. Department of State also designated Velasquez's immediate family members as ineligible to enter the United States, including Lourdes Maria Andrea Samaniego Gonzalez, Dionisio Adalberto Velasquez Jimenez, Sonia Rebecca Velasquez Esquariza, and Hugo José Velasquez Esquariza, and Duarte's immediate family members, including Ninfa Concepcion Vera Morera and Tamara Duarte Martinez. These designations reaffirm the commitment of the United States to combat corruption, which harms the public interest, hampers countries' economic prosperity, and curtails the ability of governments to respond effectively to the needs of their people. The United States continues to stand with all Paraguayans in support of democracy and the rule of law, and will continue to promote accountability for those who abuse public power for personal gain, regardless of their position or political affiliation.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.